plan and other big government programs that she's proposing. Grover Norquist is the president of Americans for Tax Reform. He tells Fox News there's no way the rich people can pay for everything, and some of Warren's programs will be paid for by the middle class.
Well, she's already told us some things. She said she'll repeal the Trump Republican tax cuts for the median income family of four. That's a $2,000 tax increase each year. For a single mother with one child, $35,000. It's a $1,300 tax increase every year. That's just, and she spent this money, by the way, many, many times. Every time she talks, it's not just Medicare for all. She's doing all sorts of other spending. And every time she tells you it's the same three rich guys are going to pay for it all. Mm. In point of fact, she talks about taxing rich people the way magicians do misdirection. They say, oh, look over here. She wants you to think she's taxing rich people. There's not enough money there to do all the things she wants. Mm-hmm. She's going to go straight to the middle class. This is what Sweden does. This is what Denmark does. This is what the European countries that spend the way she and Bernie Sanders want to. And Sanders admits he'll raise tax on the middle class.
For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Don't fear technology. Use it, understand it, and embrace it. The mission of Tech Today is to demystify technology. I'm your host, Chris Bianco, principal of Blue Panther Business Partners. Every Tuesday morning from 10 to 11, we will cover new apps, buying advice, technology news, and answer your questions. Good day, and join me on Tech Today on HuntertonChamberRadio.com.
Good afternoon, Friday, October 25th. The Halloween, decorations are out. Reminds me that I have not done anything. Looks like it'll be, who knows, for the weekend. This weekend, we have some predictions of hazardous weather. Yesterday, as we know, was beautiful. I mean, it was really gorgeous. Today started out cold and, you know, not very nice, but it turned out to be somewhat warmer this afternoon. They said about 79 degrees. Not sure we got up that high. Excuse me, I'm a little, I'm going to blubber a little bit today. So, in any event, I'm Pat Smiths. Your weather tonight is mostly cloudy. Tomorrow should be the best day of the weekend. In fact, absolutely the best day, because tomorrow should be partly sunny, high of about 62 degrees. Then on Saturday night, there's a 30% chance of showers, and then showers are likely, 60% chance of rain by tomorrow night. And then Sunday, heavy rain predicted, 100% prediction, heavy rain, 67 degrees, so it's going to be warmer, but it is going to heavy rain. And then Sunday night, slight chance of showers, low of about 51 degrees, so it's not going to be that cold. Tonight, the low is expected around 45. I think we've been getting frost in some areas. Other areas of the township, probably not, or I should say the county. Then by Monday, should be nice, mostly sunny again, high of about 68 degrees. Going into Monday night, partly cloudy, and then a chance, about a 30% chance of rain. So we'll be back. It's the law. And just we'll play a couple spots and then be back with the program.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Okay, we're back. I'm Pat Smiths, program It's the Law. Just wanted to bring you up to date on some of the things that have been happening legally. But again, I was asked to remind people, remind all of us, that we need to be a little more careful when we're claiming automobile expenses. And so I've said this before, but I think it's worth repeating. If you want to deduct automobile expenses in your business, this is really relevant because it has nothing to do with the ordinary day-to-day use of your personal vehicle for non-business purposes or even commuting. So if you commute 100 miles a day, guess what? It's not deductible. However, if you own a business and use a car, then really this is important because you can either use a car for business purposes for your employer, and even if your employer is you, in other words, if you're employed in your own business or you work for an employer where you use a car for business, meaning your car, and the employer reimburses you. And so that's important. The employer needs to reimburse you. So if you have a job where you're just expected to use your car, then you don't have the right to deduct it. But if your employer reimburses you for using the car, and then either your employer or you, of course, would claim your auto expenses as a business expense. However, there are a couple points that you really need to pay attention to. I'm sorry, I'm one of the people who probably don't keep as clear a track as I should, because it's very seldom that you can actually deduct a car 100% of the use of a car, because the IRS isn't going to believe it. So what you need to do is maintain a log of business use of your car. It can be almost any form. It doesn't have to be formal, because you can just have, you know, little notebook, sheets of paper, but you need to indicate in the log which day you drove, where you drove, and for what purpose, how many miles, as I said, the client or the purpose of the business, and the mileage. So if you follow these requirements, you're in a great position to support your auto expenses to the satisfaction of the IRS. So these are the key elements. Obviously, there's more involved whenever you're questioned by the IRS. But over the years, I will talk to accountants, and they say that the most difficult part of everything is the self-discipline that their clients need to maintain, in other words, this log. So don't, at the end of the year, pull out a notebook and in the same pen, same ink, same writing, do a whole year, because nobody's going to believe it. It looks like you did what you did, which is, after the fact, make this up. So, you can no longer deduct auto expenses on your 1040 as unreimbursed employee expenses. So that's another thing that's important. If, in fact, and what we all used to do, if we were employed and we would just deduct the auto expenses on our 1040 as unreimbursed employee expenses. So what, remember, we now have to recover the cost. You or your business or your employer must pay for the expenses or reimburse you. Now, one of the things I find also helpful is to keep a log of gas. Now, I use credit cards for business, and I keep track of all the gas for the vehicle I use for business. I charge that on the credit card. And hold on, I'm just going to get in some noise here, so I'll pay a spot.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterton at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterton, the voice for mental health in Hunterton County.
Back again. I think most people know that the studio, our radio studio, or station, I guess we might want to call it, studio station, in any event, is in the chamber building, which is great, but sometimes if we leave the door open, it can be rather noisy, so I apologize. And just to get back with what I was saying, I find it very helpful to keep a separate credit card, and if you keep one car for business and charge all of the gas, etc., on that card, it can be helpful, but that doesn't mean you should not keep a log. And certainly, if you use your car for business almost all the time, the easier thing would be to keep a log of the personal use. However, you know, if the IRS ever looks into this, they can be real sticklers. And it's certainly not worth running into a problem because you're deducting automobile expenses that you can't prove. So that's the tip for today on that. And as I said, just get that notebook, put it in the car, and if you're not doing it now, make sure that's your New Year's resolution. But honestly, you should start. It's never too late to start this. So what else is happening in the world of the courts? Well, I've been on trial for 2 weeks, so what's happening is I'm pretty tired. But the other things, you know, Johnson & Johnson, most of us know this company. I think we all do in New Jersey. There was an $8 billion punitive damages verdict that Johnson & Johnson was ordered to pay a user of the company's Risperdal drug in a Philadelphia courtroom earlier this month. And now that could be the harbinger of jurors growing and their growing hostility towards drug companies. At least that's what legal experts are saying. And, you know, I don't know if anybody really expects that $8 billion punitive damages to hold up. But, you know, that's what's happening because drug companies are not favored defendants in these actions. So what, you know, there have been a number of criminal law cases. There was a, the defendant in this case, State versus Hung, was approved for publication. It was a criminal case. And I don't know if you say the Hung or Huang. It's H-U-A-N-G. It was a publication. It was this went up to the Supreme Court, which is a little unusual for this type of a case to wind its way all the way up to the Supreme Court, but it did. And so the appellant in this case, now this was the Supreme Court decision, he appealed from the appellate division's judgment reversing the dismissal of the defendant's indictment for second-degree vehicular homicide of a child and a fourth-degree assault by auto of the child's mother. So in support of his motion to dismiss, the defendant presented evidence indicating that he made a left turn onto a four-lane road from a commercial highway. And then in the midst of his turn, defendant applied a three-quarter acceleration with no braking. As a result, he lost control of his vehicle, crossed all four lanes of the highway, mounted the opposite sidewalk, and struck multiple signs and a planter. Then, without stopping his vehicle, he then proceeded through an intersection while still on the curb. He re-entered the highway, traversed all four lanes against, and ultimately came to a stop after hitting a tree. So what happened is a support from one of the signs struck by the defendant hit a six-year-old child in the head, causing fatal trauma. And also the child's mother suffered internal injuries when she was struck by a piece of the sheared metal from the signs, from one of the signs at least. Now, the trial court agreed with the defendant that the evidence presented to the grand jury failed to establish that the defendant drove recklessly. The appellate division reversed, ruling that the defendant's acceleration into the highway, or onto the highway, his loss of control, and failure to stop until he hit a tree sufficiently established that the defendant was aware that he was operating a vehicle in such a manner or under such circumstances as to create a substantial and unjustifiable risk of death and serious bodily injury. So that was the standard, operating a vehicle in such a manner or under such circumstances as to create a substantial and unjustifiable risk of death and serious bodily injury. And also that he consciously disregarded this risk. So the appellate division therefore concluded that there was sufficient evidence before the grand jury to establish the element of recklessness. And however, there was a dissenting opinion, and that's why the case automatically goes up to the New Jersey Supreme Court. It's fairly rare for the appellate division to have a dissent. But when it's a three-judge panel, and it would always be a three-judge panel because they'd be sure to have three judges if there was any concern about a dissent. So in this case, one of the judges dissented and indicated that the defendant's conduct fell into a category of civil negligence rather than criminal recklessness. So that was the difference. Was it civil negligence or criminal recklessness? And so because of that, the defendant had a right to appeal. When I say because of that, I mean because of the one of the judges dissented, the man had a right to appeal. And so on appeal, however, the court affirmed for the reasons expressed by the majority in the appellate division. So in this case, the appellate division, this was the appellate division that the Supreme Court upheld, and what they said the state appealed from the dismissal of an indictment charging the defendant with vehicular manslaughter, homicide. Homicide by an auto, and this, of course, is the child, and also fourth degree assault because of the child's mother being struck and injured by the falling debris. Now I'm not going to be able to say that word. You know what I'm talking about. Debris, not the falling debris. So along with the evidence presented to the grand jury included a video along with data from the defendant's vehicle revealing the rate of acceleration as the defendant attempted to turn onto a four-lane highway from a commercial, commercial parking lot. I thought it was not, but in other words, he was coming out of a commercial parking lot, and the way he accelerated as he turned onto the highway. So, of course, I've talked to you about what happened, and, of course, on appeal, the appellate division reversed the dismissal of the defendant's indictment, and the appellate division rejected the trial court's conclusion that the evidence did not support the case of recklessness, and so that they prosecutor was not able to proceed on that. And the appellate division noted that the loss of control, the acceleration, failure to brake, etc., did, by doing all those things, he disregarded the risk of serious bodily injury or death that his driving was creating. Now, the dissenting opinion was Judge Fuentes. He argued that while the defendant's conduct could lead to a finding of negligence in a civil trial, it did not rise to the level of criminal recklessness. Now, this was also approved for publication, so what we now know is the Supreme Court did not agree with Judge Fuentes. They agreed with the majority. Obviously, the takeaway is certainly he should not have accelerated the way he did, but, you know, as that happened, he needed to stop immediately. And it's a good lesson for all of us that we have to be very careful because there can be unintended consequences to reckless driving. And that was obviously an unintended consequence because I'm sure that, this man, of course, it wasn't intentional, but it doesn't have to be intentional. Someone that, at least in the law circles we know, is James Pfeiffer, who is in private practice in Warren County. He was on the bench for a fairly short period of time. He was appointed as a judge in Warren County, and then he resigned, and he was a longtime private practitioner handling defense and municipal work, and so he's been named the acting Warren County prosecutor. So, not sure if that will turn into permanent. I guess it very possibly will depend on who's appointed the next governor, unless they appoint someone sooner than that. Now, the New Jersey Supreme Court has taken up the question of whether efforts to block plans for an autism group home by residents adjacent to the property implicated the state's anti-discrimination statute. So that'll be an interesting case because, the question is, can this group home will the blocking of that, is that implicate the state's anti-discrimination statute? And that will be one of the cases that will go up to the New Jersey Supreme Court, so they'll be deciding that one. And also, the Supreme Court, New Jersey Supreme Court, granted a petition for certification in a case involving civil claims against an adult teen who hosted a drinking party at his home for other adult teens, one of whom subsequently died in a fatal crash. Boy, if this doesn't, make sure that people take note of the liability if you're hosting such a party where there's drinking, it should. And that is a real concern because this is not an issue where there were underage minors. There were, he was an adult teen, so he was 18 or 19, and the other party people in his home were also adult teens. So they weren't minors. On the other hand, if it's an adult teen, he would not be, and nor would the other teenagers there, be of drinking age. Interesting dispute, but they're still not of drinking age. There is also, there are all of these drug cases that come up. This has not been one that was published. However, I think it's fairly interested. I'm interested. even though I don't do criminal law. And anyone who is deciding that they're going to transport drugs should be interested in all of these cases. And this is, there was a trial court, and the trial court order suppressed the drugs seized during a roadside stop. So the defendant, Mr. Floyd, was stopped, roadside stop, and there were drugs. So this is an appellate division case. So following the seizure of the drugs, the defendant was indicted for drug offenses. So what happened is the police officers observed a narcotics sale, and they identified the sailor, they identified the seller as an individual the officer referred to as S1. So as a result, they conducted surveillance of S1's home over the next few weeks and observed multiple suspected drug transactions. So a confidential informant also advised the officer that S1 was expecting a large shipment of cocaine. So while surveilling S1's home, the officer witnessed a white Mercedes park in front of the home. So the following day, the officer observed the Mercedes meet up with S1's vehicle and drive back to S1's residence. So the driver of the Mercedes entered S1's home via the backyard, reemerging and throwing something in his trunk. And so what happened is a car, meaning the Mercedes, pulled away. The officers followed, and the Mercedes driver, later identified as the defendant, Mr. Floyd, was observed by the officers, and they observed him committing multiple driving infractions. So another officer was asked to conduct a traffic stop of defendant in view of the surveilling officers. So the officer who conducted the stop discovered that defendant's license was suspended. As a result of that, the defendant was arrested. So the officer had his drug detection canine with him. And the canine alerted to the presence of narcotics in the trunk. So as a result of the canine basically sniffing out the drugs, they searched the trunk and revealed the presence of cocaine. They also found marijuana in the passenger compartment. The trial judge in that case suppressed the drugs, ruling that the positive cocaine sniff obligated the officers to obtain a search warrant. And on appeal, the appellate division reversed, ruling that the police could deploy a drug detection canine while conducting a lawful stop for traffic violations, and had probable cause to conduct the warrantless search when the canine alerted to the presence of narcotics. So what was significant here is that the officer, when they conducted the stop, they did so after they found, or they saw him, observed him, committing multiple driving infractions. So, frankly, you know, it's very easy sometimes for them to observe what would be multiple driving infractions. So the fact that there were multiple driving infractions, or even one, enabled the police to stop the car, and the appellate division said they did not have to wait and get a search warrant once the dog sniffed out the cocaine. So, the moral of the story is don't carry drugs. But in any event, that was something that could happen to a lot of people. And, you know, it's going to result if, in fact, there are any infractions. So, I guess the best advice if you're carrying drugs is to, you know, really obey all traffic laws. No headlight out, no changing lanes inappropriately, no running through the yellow light when you know it's going to turn red, et cetera, et cetera. But, and of course, we know that the reason they were following him, but they can, the police can follow you, and if in fact you are violating the laws, you can be, meaning the driving infraction, you can be pulled over for that. Okay, why don't we take a couple spots and then we'll come back with more cases and decisions as to what's happening in the law.
Hello, this is Nicole Smith, host of Happy to Help. Would you like to discover the secret to happiness? I talk to volunteers, executive directors, fundraisers, and authors about how nonprofit engagement enriches their lives. We thrive when we have a sense of purpose in our lives. Philanthropy is the new community. Tune in to Happy to Help every Wednesday at 10 a.m. to discover how to find your purpose and live well by doing good.
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
Okay, we're back. And what's some of the other news? Well, I guess sometimes there can be prosecutors who are also possibly prosecuted. So in Morris County, the Morris prosecutor faces a racial discrimination lawsuit from a pair of detectives, and that's a federal civil rights lawsuit by members of his, two members of his detective staff. And whether that goes anywhere, well, we'll find out. So there, actually, there was a congratulations of the New Jersey Lawyers Fund for Client Protection on its 50th anniversary. This is an entity of the state Supreme Court, and this is a fund that reimburses clients when a lawyer misappropriates or misuses their funds. And so that I think a lot of people don't realize it, that every attorney in the state has to contribute into this fund on a yearly basis. And if, in fact, an attorney steals your money or somehow misuses your funds, that is probably, you know, the most serious offense. There are certainly other things that get attorneys disbarred, but this is, everybody in New Jersey knows, or every attorney knows, that if you take money out of a trust account, for example, and this is detected through either a random audit or some other means, you're going to get disbarred. And in New Jersey, disbarment is for life. So you can imagine the difficulty that lawyers who are, for example, compulsive gamblers might have if they're holding a lot of money in their trust accounts. But the So the other thing, there was a 260 million dollar opiate settlement, and apparently about 60 lawyers in Cleveland hammered out a last minute settlement on the eve of the first jury trial over the opiate crisis, so that they did not have to select a jury. And actually, I think in that case, the jury may have already been selected, and it would have just been, opening statements in the trial and preceded that. This is not going to go away, folks, nor is the opiate crisis going to go away. And interestingly, I happened to witness a situation where someone had to go for med checks. And, 2 weeks ago, the person could barely stand. And the last week, or probably the last 10 days, was a different person. Pretty obvious that he was cleaning up because he knew that he had to go for this med check. And then day after the med check, he again was just really impaired. So in any event, that's a terrible, terrible problem. And, I was just very concerned if this person got into a car and was able to drive away. He was no condition, obviously, to drive. So in any event, tough. And interestingly, it was so apparent to anyone who would have seen him that, when he went into the doctor for this check and another prescription, because that's what happens when you're on prescription medication, the doctors can only give a certain prescription. I think it's a 30-day prescription. So, of course, the doctor doesn't know how much somebody is taking in between the doctor visits, and it's pretty easy to, buy and exchange pills for something else. So the again, this Risperdal verdict, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, Risperdal, the $8 billion verdict against J&J, what convinces jurors to come up with such stratospheric awards? I mean, why in the world would, most of us can't even think about $8 billion. Why would a jury verdict be that high? Is it a message? I can't help but believe they think that it will be decreased by the court. Certainly there would be an appeal no matter what it was. There was another non-published, but of course if it's family law, I'm always interested in it. And the this case was Benedetto versus Tosti, and the case, it was not published, but the defendant in this case, Mr. Tosti, appeals from a final judgment of divorce and a subsequent order denying his motion for relief from the judgment, and the appellate division affirmed. And the parties in this case signed a matrimonial settlement agreement, and that was in August of 2011, and the judgment of divorce wasn't until 2018. And pursuant to the terms of the matrimonial settlement agreement, the court granted a limited judgment of divorce from bed and board. in 2011. And so that is not, and certainly wasn't, uncommon. And probably bed and board is a divorce in every sense. It's a limited divorce only in the sense that a party with a bed and board divorce can't get remarried. So in every other way, it is the same as a full divorce. But people, and back in 2011, back a few years especially, this was popular when there was a situation with the spouse who did not have medical insurance. And so we as attorneys would negotiate a bed and board divorce so that in those cases, although we'd have to warn both spouses that the company might not go along with it, in most cases the companies allowed the wife to stay on the medical insurance. So that although there was in this case, the marital settlement agreement had a mutual waiver of support. So that was a mutual waiver of support and stated any language contained in two of the most important cases or any other case, the alimony waiver would be non-modifiable and the provision irrevocable. So so of course both parties were saying no alimony. However, notwithstanding that waiver of alimony or spousal support, the plaintiff would continue to assist financially, the defendant financially. So the plaintiff was a wife, defendant was a husband. So she agreed that she would continue to assist her husband, even though divorced from bed and board, financially in a limited manner. So in lieu of alimony or spousal support, she agreed to cover him on her medical insurance coverage as provided through her employment. And then in order to keep the defendant on her medical insurance coverage, it is agreed that the plaintiff wife would process a limited divorce from bed and board. So they spelled it right out in their agreement. Then there was a second provision that also was impacted in this case, and that they would share expenses of maintaining a vacation property. And they would have the deed prepared that would, from the defendant to the defendant and plaintiff as joint tenants with the right of survivorship. In other words, this was a vacation property that was owned, that was titled in the husband's name. And so he agreed that there would be a deed prepared from him to transfer ownership to both him and his wife. In other words, he'd retain ownership, but she would be added to the deed, and whoever survived would have the right to fully own that vacation property. So what they also put in the agreement is if one party advances any expenses to maintain the property, that party would receive credit for one half of the expenses from the sale proceeds if it was sold. And they also put in a very common provision that the agreement was made voluntarily by both parties, and they recognized that the agreement was fair, reasonable, and equitable, and that neither party was coerced or forced to enter into the terms of this agreement. Goes on, but it's very specific, and certainly to protect the parties from coming back later on and saying they didn't understand it. And the fact that the plaintiff had been represented by an attorney while the defendant waived his right to seek counsel and to have an attorney review the agreement. So this was a situation where the wife's attorney prepared the agreement, and in every case, the husband would have had an opportunity to review it. He didn't. And so they both acknowledged that they read the agreement and that they understand it, and there was full disclosure. And so there was also nothing that would be construed as relinquishment of either party for the right to defend any suit for divorce in any court of proper jurisdiction. So even though they were limiting this to a limited divorce, they indicated that either party could proceed with a divorce, not just from bed and board. So the court in this case, although it's unpublished, put large sections of their agreement in this decision. And what happened is that following the divorce from bed and board, the plaintiff, former wife, continued to insure the defendant on her state health insurance plan at her expense, as was required by the agreement. And in 2014, she filed a motion to enforce the marital settlement agreement, including converting from the divorce from bed and board to an absolute divorce. So the defendant, former husband, filed a cross motion for various relief. Now, even though the motion judge issued a tentative decision, the parties entered into a consent order resolving the motion. So in pertinent part, the plaintiff agreed to withdraw without prejudice her request for an absolute divorce and agreed to continue to provide the defendant with health insurance through her employment. So, and he agreed to comply with the agreement relating to issues raised in her enforcement motion. So the consent order also stated that the alimony waiver provisions would continue as set forth in the agreement. And in the event that the plaintiff seeks to convert the limited divorce from bed and board to absolute divorce, the issue over the cost of medical insurance is without prejudice to either party's right in a future determination regarding the cost of that insurance. So in 2018, the former wife informed the former husband that she intended to retire and of the inability to maintain him on her health insurance coverage after retirement. So in response, the defendant filed a motion to enforce litigants' rights and to modify equitable distribution and alimony. So, and then the plaintiff filed a cross motion seeking an absolute divorce. So the judge who heard the motion essentially denied defense's motion related to a modification of alimony and equitable distribution. Now, the equitable distribution statute is pretty clear. You can't go back and modify equitable distribution. But as to the enforcement part of the defendant's motion, which was funds he claimed were due for maintenance of the New York property, the judge said he had not provided sufficient proofs to make a determination, and so that issue had to abide discovery and a settlement conference that would be scheduled at a future date. Now, as to the relief sought in the plaintiff's motion, the judge ordered the parties to conduct brief discovery regarding the impact of an absolute divorce on the defendant's health care coverage. And also, judge ordered the parties to attempt to reach settlement on the issue, and failing that, to schedule a settlement conference. So the judge was trying to say, work it out. So apparently at a settlement conference, the defendant attempted to address claims that the judge had already denied relating to the modification of alimony and equitable distribution. And the trial judge found that the defendant's lack of financial resources were not relevant to his request to modify equitable distribution because equitable distribution is not subject to a change of circumstances. And that's really the case. If there's fraud, it's different. But you can't just come in and say, well, the fact that, some asset was not distributed or was distributed, you can't modify that. However, the judge also upheld the alimony waiver provision in this case, noting that the agreement stated the waiver would stand regardless of a change in financial circumstances. And so the judge found there was no basis to revisit the alimony waiver on account of the defendant's claim of poor health because his certification stated those claims predated the entry of the agreement. So in other words, he knew what his health situation was before he signed the marital settlement agreement. And also the judge concluded that neither party owed the other a reimbursement related to the once marital real estate they continued to own post-judgment. So the judge also granted plaintiff's request for an absolute divorce, and it gave the defendant 30 days from the final judgment to obtain his own medical insurance coverage and thereafter relieve the plaintiff of responsibility. So the defendant filed an appeal. While the appeal was pending, he filed a motion seeking the same relief. The plaintiff filed a cross motion for enforcement because he had failed to comply with certain aspects of that earlier order. So the motion judge denied the defendant's request without prejudice. And of course, in that case, and it's important to know that once someone files an appeal, a trial court lacks jurisdiction based on the pending appeal except to do anything other than enforce prior order. Because in order to, well, I shouldn't say order, but if someone wants the trial judge to stay provisions of an order, that can be requested. But unless the trial court does stay provisions of a trial court order, whatever the decision on that is, someone has to comply. So because in this case there was a pending appeal, and then the defendant, I guess he would say he got shot down when he tried to go back on a new motion. However, the appellate division allowed him to amend his notice of appeal. And that way he could include the latest order. And the court, the appellate court, talked about the fact that they generally defer to factual findings of the trial court, because the trial court has the firsthand credibility judgments about witnesses. And it has a feel of the case, etc. And also they talk about the family part's special jurisdiction. And, deference is especially appropriate when evidence is largely testimonial and involves questions of credibility. So that in this case, the defendant said that the trial court erred in not dealing with the defendant's substantial material change of circumstances. And the court should have reviewed the validity of the MSA contract. And the court should have, in this case, argued the court should take a fresh look at the entirety of the trial court's dismissal of the relief. And, of course, also defendant's many pleadings, including requests for fair and equitable distribution of marital assets, etc. So they asked for everything. And what happened here is the appellate division affirmed, they considered all of the arguments and affirmed substantially for the reasons expressed by the motion judge. And then they added some comments and said, for example, defendant was not entitled to alimony because the party's alimony waiver expressly disclaimed any ability to revisit the waiver. So, and it did. It was very specific, including the fact that his health or decrease in Social Security receipts and his overall financial circumstances, he waived the right to come back on any of those based on the terms of the agreement. And also, it was interesting to say that he argued that the plaintiff should have filed a case information statement, which is a financial statement, when he failed to demonstrate, the court said that the plaintiff's former wife was not required to file a case information statement when he failed to demonstrate a change in circumstances to overcome the alimony waiver. And also, apparently, the health-related evidence in his brief on appeal was not presented to the trial judge. So you can't go up and appeal something new. That's basically what it is. Because then, since it wasn't provided to the trial judge, they can't consider it either. This is interesting, they said they decline defendant's invitation to review the fairness of the settlement agreement as a whole on the grounds that it is one-sided and the product of duress and fraud, and because the defendant entered into it without an attorney. And they, again, said that the arguments were raised for the first time on appeal, and as a result, they cannot consider them. So they discuss, in their cases where they discuss the limited circumstances in which an appellate court will consider an argument that's first raised on appeal. And so in this case, the defendant expressly acknowledged the waiver of counsel in the marital settlement agreement. Therefore, it's not a basis to undo that agreement. In other words, he can't come back later when he's expressly waived his right to counsel to then come back and say that's a basis to undo the agreement. So they go on with other things, but this is a well-reasoned opinion, and first of all, if nothing else, it shows that someone should, in fact, have an attorney, because what's happening in a case like this is, you know, there is legal language in any agreement, and if someone waives their right to an attorney to review it, frankly, they should get stuck, because this is a ploy that is used by some people to say, hey, wait a minute, not fair, and it has to be overturned. Well, that's the end of the program. Let me play the news, and we'll be back with the sports guys. I'll play a couple spots, and we'll be back shortly.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the...
Sabía que de cada cinco personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental. NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.